Hello and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm your host, Hady Adams. This week, we look at Africa's urban future. As people across the continent make the move to the cities, how will those urban areas deliver on the hopes and aspirations of those coming and those who are already there? We'll also talk smart cities in Africa. What are they? Do African countries really need them? And how smart is the idea itself? We'll get a reality check from our guests and we'll tell you why some in South Africa were not prepared to see this photo on the cover of Time magazine. I'll speak to the photographer behind that image and he'll tell us why he keeps flying his drone over cities in Africa and around the world. All of that and more coming up. Straight Talk Africa starts now. What do you like about the city you live in? And if there's one thing you could change about it, what would it be?
My city is Accra, Ghana. What I love about my city is how cosmopolitan this place is. The diversity with people, culture, food is so beautiful to see. If I could change one thing about my city though, it would definitely be the cost of living here. Living in Accra is so expensive.
My city is Kigali, Rwanda. What I like about my city is the weather. If I could change one thing about my city, it would be its size, because it's too small and so there are not always new things to discover.
Hey, this is Joseph, and this is my city, Abidjan. If there's one thing I like about my city, it's the great places to visit, the good food, and the very nice people. If there's one thing I would change about my city, it would be the drainage systems. Because here, once it rains, it pours, and some places are not very pretty.
My name is Shadrach Agamira from Kenya 254. Nairobi is my city. And if there's one thing I love about Nairobi is that it has hospitable people. It's the city, I think, around the world that has a national park next to the city, not a zoo. Very nice. Interesting. You can see the view on you from a balcony of any hotel. Nairobi is just amazing. But again, if you ask me if there's one thing I should change, it'll be the order. The order in the city, security, traffic, all that. But hey, Nairobi is a very beautiful and amazing, interesting city.
This is the city I am from, Cape Town, South Africa. What I like about this city is its natural beauty, the cultural diversity, and the creativity of the people. And then there's the food. Oh, the food. But if there's one thing I could change about this place, it would be the inequality. In Africa's second wealthiest city, this is how the majority of residents have lived for decades, on the outskirts, in the hopes of a better life. And I too struggle with this question. Why can't we get this right? In a place with so much wealth and so many resources, why has so little changed for so many people, no matter who is in power? You see, South Africa's cities and surrounding suburbs were originally designed to divide and oppress along racial lines. And it's those effects we can still see today. South African architect Wandile Mtiane calls it apartheid architecture. And it happens in more places than you might think. He spoke to me from his home city of Durban and explained why he says this kind of design is actually genius and what he's doing to dismantle it.
So what they did was they came up with this thing called the 40-40 rule. So where they would build a 40 square meter home, which would be a labor camp for the majority of the people, black people in South Africa, place it 40 kilometers away from town where sort of the white masters lived, and then devoid those communities of economic opportunities and gathering places, because those will have political implications with them. And when what this did was it forced people to spend 40% of their income commuting 40 kilometers to go work in town, where only that's where the jobs and economic opportunities were. The laws might have changed, but the architecture didn't. So people are still spending 40% of their income commuting to work in town today. which then renders them incapable of developing their own homes and their own communities.
When Wondilin Tiane spoke at the 2019 Young Architects Conference in the U.S. city of Portland, Oregon, he gave voice to the experiences of those living in South Africa's low-income neighborhoods and his own life growing up in the Durban township of KwaMashu. Tiane says those experiences motivated him to become an architect. Speaking to me via Skype, Ntiane explains his design approach, homes and communities centered around human dignity.
Because without a dignified house, you can get a job. You don't have a physical address, and without a physical address, you can get a job. And without a job, you don't have the money to buy or build a home.
And that, he says, is how easily injustice and poverty are often built into homes and communities.
10 years after these houses have been built, we watch the news, and what we see is that that community has the highest crime rates, the highest high school dropout rates, the highest pregnancy rates, and all of these things. And we think to ourselves, like, what's wrong with the people in that community? But in reality, it's like, what's wrong with the designers and the people that created the community, right? Because people within their communities are merely living up to what's been designed for them.
Ntiane saw an opportunity to redraw the picture. He started Ubuntu Design Group, working with architects and students from around the world to solve design problems in low-income neighborhoods.
We started looking at different housing projects around the world, and we realized the majority of social housing projects around the world have failed. And they have failed because of three reasons. One, for some reason, when people are designing for low-income communities, they think that they shouldn't consult them in the designing of their own home. It's failed because whenever people design low-income communities, they put them away from economic opportunities, which is ironic because the only reason why you have slums and shantytowns is because people are trying to move closer to work. People design these social housing projects in a box which is almost impossible to add on as the family grows in number and in economy. So it practically forces people to stay within that low-income bracket.
Ntiane says it's important that architects listen first, then build.
Yeah, so basically, a lot of when it rains, the water comes in.
Ntiane's design-build approach has been celebrated at home and abroad, earning him a spot in the Obama Foundation Leadership Program and on the global stage. In partnership with his American alma mater, Andrews University, Ntiane is working to redesign and improve homes and lives in the place that matters most to him, African communities like the one he comes from. He has also developed the Ubuntu Architecture Summer Abroad program, inviting architects from around the world to learn in and from Africa.
Architecture in the continent and around the world is very Eurocentric, right? So you learn about Rome, you learn about the Baroque, you learn about Renaissance, but you don't learn about Zulu architecture, you don't learn about the Great Zimbabwe, you don't learn about the underground churches in Ethiopia. So what it's doing is it's bringing in architecture students from around the world, being taught by Africans. So it's a practical learning, it's design build, and it also enables them to work with other young folks from around the world as they design spaces and places that are more inclusive.
Ntiane says just as apartheid architecture was designed to oppress and segregate, he's committed to design justice as a foundation to empower low-income communities and ultimately liberate them.
Architect Wandile Ntiane sharing his ideas and his work with me from Durban, South Africa. Now, much has been said and written about rapid urbanization on the continent. This idea that people leave the rural parts of their country and move to the city in search of jobs and a better life. But are Africa's cities really delivering on those opportunities and dreams of a better life? And what can we do to make sure our urban spaces work not only for those who are coming, but for those who are already living there? Earlier, I spoke to Imana Nsikan George. She's a climate researcher and sustainability practitioner on climate actions and joins me from Frankfurt, Germany. Also with us is Christian Benamana. He's a Rwanda-based architect and managing director of the Mass Design Group. He's also the director of the African Design Center and joins us from the Rwandan capital of Kigali. Imana and Christian, I do thank you so much for joining me. And Christian, I'm going to put the first question to you first. How do we address the inequality that we're seeing in many of our cities? Because this is not just an African issue. I mean, this plays out around the world, this demarcation between the haves and the have-nots. I see it in the city where I live now, here in the United States. I see it when I go back to the city that I'm originally from. I have to wonder sometimes, is it too late in some places to turn things around?
The visible inequality you're pointing out is not the problem. Like, that is a result of systemic failures of the socioeconomic and political decisions that we've made in the past and implemented in policies that enables those things to go on for a very long time to a point where they begin to manifest themselves physically in the built space. For me, the starting point of addressing those issues does not lie in reworking the physical arrangement of the physical space of the cities, but it's about addressing the thinking, the policies, the ideology that has created an environment in which the proliferation of these ideas have gone in a way that we feel comfortable building them in physical spaces of our cities.
Imana, how do you see it?
Cities, it's a nomenclature which we gave to spaces that are densely populated because of the strategic relevance of certain infrastructure that were actually being developed in these spaces. So it doesn't mean that it has changed the development dynamics of Africa in any way. The texture, the problems, the development challenges which we have in Africa has been moved from the rural areas to where we call cities. So it doesn't change the texture of the society in any way. That a space is called a city is simply because of the strategic location or the strategic locations of certain government institutions or utilities, public utilities that are available and which people get attracted to for leaving the rural areas in order to find empowerment, in order to find work, in order to find improvement in lives. That does not in any way dismantle the age-long structure of irresponsive government and a very weak development capacity of our government.
And yet we see megacities springing up across the continent. And just for some background for our viewers here, I'm talking about megacities like Cairo, Kinshasa, Lagos. These are cities with a population of at least 10 million people. And the United Nations says places like Dar es Salaam, Luanda and Johannesburg, they're set to become megacities in less than 10 years' time. And then in the 10 years after that, we'll see places like Nairobi and Addis Ababa becoming megacities. As people move from the rural parts of their country in search of high-paying jobs. But are these cities in any way delivering on the hopes and aspirations and the opportunities that people seek and continue to seek?
I would answer your question from two dimensions. First of all, I would say, yes, cities are actually providing the opportunities for some people and also no for other people. And for those people whose cities are providing the perceived or the intended opportunities are the people who have, I am speaking as a Nigerian from the context of where I come from, although I live in Germany. So for the people whose cities are provided opportunities for are the people who have some
connections to people who are in influences and in positions of authority. So cities have actually delivered those, fulfill the dreams of these people. And then also in terms of percentages, I think it's important to weigh. For the people who have realized their dreams in cities, in terms of comparative percentages, it would be very negligible to people who are still struggling in cities, who left the rural spaces with the hope of improving lives and conditions in the cities. In terms of percentage, it's very, very negligible, because that is why if it weren't negligible, we wouldn't have been talking about and elaborating on the concept of urban slums and urban dwellers. And so this distinction, this very clear distinction tells us that the percentage of people who have realized their dreams in cities is very negligible compared to the percentage relatively to the people who are still struggling in the dreams of poverty.
Christian, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think I agree with everything Imana is saying. There's also like an important thing to note about the transition we're making in times, especially brought up by the availability of technology. And there's something that I heard Dr. Kim, the former president of the World Bank, said that I think like resonated a lot with this kind of like transition of time that I'm mentioning, is that because of how technology is making the world become a global village, is that aspirations of people, mostly young people across the world who know how to manipulate this technology really well, are converging. Like, you know, most young people who are able to consume this flow of information coming through technology are able to understand what their aspirations for a good future would look like. From a global perspective. Unfortunately, the opportunities, as Imana was saying, that is availed to these many people who are migrating in the search of those aspirations are not equally distributed. And what ends up happening is that then you have this influx of people who, of course, move to greener pastures in pursuit of these opportunities. Unfortunately, they end up being met with this disappointment. So to answer your question earlier about you know, do people fulfill these opportunities? Yes or no, I agree with Imana. Yes, there's a class of people who do actually make it happen, but their percentage is negligible, because one of the things that these cities, you know, do is like they don't provide a playing field for everybody, but they do level the playing field a little bit. So that they offer some opportunities where, like, in the rural areas, they might not be. But the challenge is the scale and the speed to which they need to respond to creating these opportunities because of, you know, increased populations and a lot of, like, you know, these things we just talk about, like, exclusive policies and those sort of things. And that's what creates this kind of like holding space that we end up calling like slums and informal settlements and everything else, because like then everybody's held within that physical and space and time while, you know, they get on this long line of waiting. And most of the time, like, you know, it takes too long and then becomes like this permanent thing that was normally supposed to be, you know, temporary. So I think that phenomenon is an added challenge to urbanization, especially in you know, fast developing areas of the world, which Africa is at the helm of it. Like our urbanization in Africa is still really low, and as like we transition from like, you know, a higher urbanization percentage, like this problem is going to be worse and worse and worse.
I want to talk now about smart cities. The last time I was in Johannesburg, I have to share with you, I went in search of these elusive smart cities. In Johannesburg, it was supposed to have been in a place called Modderfontein, and that literally means fountain of mud. So I went there, and what I found was no smart city, probably more mud than city. Now, Imana, I know you have a lot to say on this issue. You've written about it extensively. So I'm going to let Christian get a word in here. What are these smart cities? Am I missing something here? Where are they? Are they coming? Are they here? How will they work? Where will everybody live? And then are they really such a smart idea?
Oh my God. I hope I can answer that question, because I'm confused myself about smart cities. But every time I try to think about concepts that are complicated, I try to simplify them as much as I can. And the way my thought process is to try to eliminate what the thing I'm trying to think about is not. And when I think about it, the smart cities, in my opinion, in my view, are not simply cities of the future, or cities that, you know, operate like a very different type of like living systems than the current cities. And that's why, for me, I like to think them as smarter cities, because I want to believe that cities are inherently smart. They're systems, whether we recognize them or not, that run our cities, that are very smart in ways that we don't even fully understand them, whether we acknowledge them or not, but allow cities like Lagos, that has 21 million people, to still exist today with whatever conditions that, you know, they live in. I'm not saying that those systems cannot be improved, and that's why I want to think about what you talk about as smarter cities. And when I think about them in that way, like we need our cities to be smarter, then I think about what we are leaning on as tools and means to make them smarter. In the case of smart cities, is mostly technology, where there's this concept that the availability and the advancements we have to date in technology can allow us to make the systems we rely on to make our cities livable, workable, and, you know, like good places to live in, make them function better. So we can have like more efficient transportation systems. We can have more service deliveries for cities. We can make it easier for people to access utilities, as Imana was pointing out, like to pay for those services. We can make people to, you know, to improve connectivity around the city. Like we can allow people to schedule the use of spaces in cities in much more efficient ways and, you know, equal way and things like that. So for me, like a smart city, like is less about solving like the fundamental challenges that me and Imana were talking about earlier, that, you know, cities fundamentally cannot solve by themselves, like that those are solutions we need to find from elsewhere. But smart cities is like, how do we allow the current knowledge you have in technology and information sharing and systems to make our cities more livable and more inclusive for people?
And Imana, you wrote a blog post about this where you ask whether Africa is really ready for the smart city concept. And I just want to read some of what you've written. We must avoid the creation of a new class of unfit for smart city urban dwellers in growing African slums, where spatial and socioeconomic exclusion reinforced by a poor HDI, that's Human Development Index, exist. Millions of disempowered Africans risk being invisible and uncaptured in urban development maps. I invited you onto the show just to ask you, what do you mean by this?
Maybe I should start by saying that it should be very interesting for us to trace back the origin of this concept of smart city. If I remember very well, it came it has been there for quite a while, since the days of IBM, but it actually resurfaced when during the era of climate change and people trying to find sustainable ways of doing things and cutting emissions. And then we got very smart researchers, very smart intellectual with very deep conceptual understanding of sustainability came up with the buzzword of smart cities. And so smart cities mean different things for different people. So for the researchers, In the climate change movement globally, smart city means improvement in operations. It means the ease of doing things. But to some other people, in smart cities means taking 1,000 leap from what it used to be in the pre-industrial areas. But for me, as an individual, I think smart cities, for me, when in the context of Africa, means or should mean an innovative governance system that can recreate itself into responding to emerging realities and emerging development problems. So it's not about, you could be smart without technology. You could be smart without having to build a Silicon Valley in Africa. All it needs is to improve on the basic fundamental development bedrock that the human society needs to make life more meaningful. And that is what smart means to me. So smart means to people like Dr. Cohen, bringing technological solutions in finding very innovative ways of doing things, making things look seamlessly done, improving lives in the urban spaces. But for me, I think smart city means or should mean a government that is responsible to innovating itself and recreating itself to dealing with the lived challenges of its people as it unfolds. That is what smart city or what a smart city concept in Africa should mean to me. It's not about, it shouldn't imply being ambitious in joining the bandwagon to regurgitate the term smart city and then leaving over 20 million people or over 50 million people wangling in poverty. That isn't smart. That is not being smart at all.
We're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, our guests talk to me about building and planning in a way that is smart, sustainable, and fair. Also, we'll show you the urban divide from the sky and why these images should be a wake-up call for cities around the world. Back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. We're showing you beautiful images of the Kigali skyline in Rwanda and the city's famous convention center, said to be Africa's most expensive building with a breathtaking $300 million price tag. This famous landmark was unveiled in 2016 and is said to have many eco-friendly features. And that's part of what we're discussing today. Are Africa's cities delivering on the aspirations of those who move there for a better life and for those who are already there? Here's more now from my conversation with Rwandan architect Christian Benimana and climate specialist Imana Nsikan George. I asked my guests how governments in Africa, policymakers and urban planners can work to make cities function better for everyone and what their advice would be.
We all know the needs of our communities, and then I would want to quickly ask, how would you think you will be able to, I'm actually referring to the government in Africa, how would you think you'd be able to design cities that captures the need of your communities or the needs of the rural urban migrators when you don't even capture them in your statistics? How do you do that? When you don't even have a system that can integrate their informal businesses into the well formal economic structure, how do you deal for people who are invisible on your map?
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you, Imana. Actually, I want to compliment your question because it's a very important question. We do actually have many communities on the continent of Africa that do not depend on land. We have nomads populations that don't really have boundaries
Absolutely.
With countries.
Absolutely.
And we have communities that live on waters, and everybody talking about cities in Africa is talking about master planning on land. Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you. Yeah, please go ahead.
Exactly, you're right. We're actually on the same page. So how do you design a city when you don't have an idea of how many people need these services? How do you design a city, like he said, when you're unsure of the categorization of people who live in the coastal areas, people who are nomads, people who are living in the city itself, people who are living in the peri-urban areas? How do you design a livable city when you lose the parameters, when you don't have the parameters with which you can plan? And that's one. So two, which I said earlier, it's about the basic needs of human development has always been the same. It hasn't changed.
I think my biggest advice is to differentiate what building cities is and is not. The building cities that happen in the Middle East and Dubai and UAE countries and everything else, that's not what building cities are. I'm not an urban planner, but I've started educating myself as an architect. There have been very efficient and good livable cities that did not have like 1,000 tall buildings in the past, and they offered a very good life based in the era in which they were set and established. I think Africa right now also needs to define what, actually, I wouldn't even use the word cities, what Africa urban living means. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It might not be cities. It might not be living in buildings that are, the densification and the opportunities to create densification in Africa right now are immense. And we do not have to rely on 16th century technology to think about achieving density. I'm hoping very soon we're going to have a means to transfer electricity wirelessly. People are connected via telephones. And, if government can commit to offering services online, people don't have to travel thousands of kilometers to go seek simple civic services they need to get. And economic opportunities don't have to be centralized in CBDs, where like we all have to put on ties every morning and drive our cars to go work white collar jobs. Outsourcing is being reinvented itself. So a lot of things that justify the existence of cities as we know now are going under tremendous transformation. So if those justification for cities are no longer viable option, why would Africa invest billions and billions of funding to create the same cities that are becoming obsolete pretty much? So we need to first start at redefining what urban living, or I don't even know if we should say urban, like density living or access to services and a good life and utilities and all these things means in the African context. And then start from there defining what the right habitat that can accommodate that in the most responsible way when it comes to social inclusion, environmental, economic opportunities, like everything that we want our people to have. And then what we end up with as a canvas is what we're going to work with. But I think starting from this thing called cities and put a lot of efforts in trying to make that round peg fit, a square hole or any other shape of hole, really, it's not going to work. I would rather that we figure out what the real need is first, and then figure out whatever solution is going to work to respond to that need. And that's what we should go for.
Imana, how do you see it?
So I want to draw there's a term in which my co-panelists use, which is social inclusion. So I want to draw quite quickly from the term in which you use social inclusion, and to make my contribution based on what you've just asked. I would rather ask that we slow down this dichotomy, the concept of in applying this city concept, because the more we apply, the more we build a greater dichotomy between people who are not able to move in time and space to densely populated regions, and we leave them completely. So now, what I would advise, my advice would be, the African government needs to look at its scorecard, at its SDGs scorecard, and that is where it will know whether it needs cities or whether it needs pure development. If we look at our scorecard, at the 2020 report, it says that only North Africa is making progress in terms of the 17 SDG goals. And the three goals, in fact, the two goals that we need to build this Western concept of cities, which is infrastructure, goal 9, and which is peace, goal 16, is completely lacking in Africa. So how do you begin to build a city where you lack, first of all, you lack the instrumentation? You lack an organized society. Because the people who brought in, like I said earlier, the people who invented or who re-engaged with the concept of smart city, which has been existing since the days of IBM, came up as a result of the climate change and climate change issues and sustainability practices. People thought going more technology, going more smarter would help to reduce emissions. And so that was actually the basis for the smart cities concept. But applying that in Africa, I need to draw our attention, like he said, about social inclusion, which we should use our SDGs, our report, our 2020 scorecard on the United Nations scoreboard to see how we are faring. Because we don't have at the moment, it is one thing to budget for bringing in new technologies. And it's another thing to have the implementation capacity to implement what we have budgeted for. And again, when you talk about smart cities, it's about the Western concept of understanding of smart cities. It's about innovation. How well prepared are we? What are we innovating? So I really think we should go back to our SDG scorecards and see how we are faring. We need infrastructure. ICT itself is a huge infrastructural investment. Technology is a huge investment. Building the algorithms is a huge investment. You pay experts, you pay developers to do it. And when we are scoring so low on health, when we are scoring so low on infrastructure, when we are scoring so low on building schools, I don't think we should be talking about smart cities in Africa. We should be talking about smart government and people who are willing to innovate, to find solutions to the people who need just the very basic development needs of housing, food, and health.
Now, Christian and Imana, before we wrap up here, I have a little bit of an exercise for the two of you experts. Could you walk us through a day in the life of someone living in a well-planned, well-functioning city, as you see it?
I mean, if I dream a little bit here, I would say that the future of urban living, especially in Africa, is going to be split in being physical and being virtual. I imagine a time when somebody, a college student who lives at home but still go to university, will wake up in the morning and check in with, I don't know how many circles of friends people have then, depends on the apps they're on. And I leave a place where I spend the night, where I slept, because I booked that place for I don't know how many days. I can leave here, I can leave elsewhere. And I can call my motorcycle or my cab from the same phone, and the person that picks me up is a stranger, is a person that either I don't know, I don't have to have a necessary connection with, but they know exactly where they're taking me and everything else. And I can make as many choices as I want based on what I can afford, based on the type of comfort I want to have. A lot of decisions that we need to make and seem to be very difficult decisions are made easy. And if you want to have a coffee ready by the time you pass by this junction so you can pick it up, you order it on your way and you continue. Like the systems around you make it very easy for you to make some of these decisions that are mundane but take like a lot of time for that particular person. Lunch options are also, you know, you can have it where you're going because you can order it, somebody delivers it to you. You can have it by yourself in a park but still connected to your friends or still like, you know, learning your class or everything else. It doesn't have to be, lunch doesn't have to be taken at noon. You can take it at 10 a.m. depending on whatever, you know, time zones you happen to choose to work from at that particular time. You can be in Lagos and you are on New York time zone and because that's the university you're going to and that excuses your schedule in contrast with the, you know, the 9-to-5 schedule that, you know, we're being subject to in Lagos at this point in time. So I see basically like a timeless, like bound schedule and a time where we, like that person, that college student can leave their brain capacity to make decisions about important things, like the things we're discussing today, but not, I need to go to town and your brain is already consumed by the traffic jam you're going to go through to get there. You have to wait for 2 hours to get a taxi or to get a motor. You don't know if you're going to die because of, you know, road accident and all those sort of things. You can know what road to avoid and all these sort of things. So for me, like, that's the kind of, like, thing I imagine is based on that. And I know that's not, like, smart cities or like, but for me it's like a facilitated living, if I can call it that way, that makes things that are difficult for us today much easier.
Well, I imagined a functional space where someone can keep an appointment I imagine it so that I can make a commitment to an appointment and I'm able to get to the appointment place quite on time. That's what I imagine. I imagine a functional city being one that I can only, that all I need to have is a driver's license to permit me to drive, and I don't need to have a car, but I can travel to another city only by just booking online and getting to book the kind of car hires we have in Europe and minimizing emissions. I imagine a functional city wherein I generate waste from my house, but I don't know where the waste ends up. So I don't see them on the streets, and I don't know where it ends up. That's the functional city, where the government takes, where the government has well-structured waste management facilities that all I need to do is just to segregate my waste, and the government takes care of the other things. So I imagine a city where I buy and do the shopping, but I don't know where the waste materials end up because I don't see them on the streets. I imagine a smart city, a functional city, where I can walk from the train, which I do in Germany. I do some of my walks while on the train going to work. That's a functional city for me. So that's the idea I have. I imagine a functional city for a day-to-day person in Africa that I can, like he said, access data when I need to. That's my imagination of a functional city.
Imana and Sikan George in Frankfurt, Germany, and Christian Benimana in Kigali, Rwanda, thank you so much for being with me. I do appreciate your time. Now, we also put a question to you on social media. What does the ideal African city look like to you? Now, Kwamina Sagu Ekromet from Ghana says an ideal city should be green, clean, carbon neutral, energy efficient, self-sustaining, with no slums and no crime. Amenga Tarumum from Nigeria wants a city with ultra-modern structures and skyscrapers like the ones in New York. Ahimbisibwe Brian from Uganda wants a natural city with trees planted within a well-advised radius by environmental specialists. It must have good waste disposal, a superb transport network that's environmentally friendly, and modern infrastructure for doing business. Can't argue with that. Alison Lemery from Sudan believes an ideal African city must showcase the cultures and should be in line with climate goals. Traditional African structures should not be ignored, but rather redesigned for a new era without removing the past. That way we can avoid destruction of our cultures and also save the environment, he says. I really, really like that idea. Angaba Atesiuk Peter from Ghana says his ideal African community would have homes built with mud, surrounded by trees, and where the river bodies are preserved. Lastly, homes should be arranged in order and not be crowded. Effie Najuma in South Sudan simply wants no traffic, no hawkers, and no slums. And then one of our top Facebook fans has a message for me this week. James Rai Majuk from South Sudan says, I welcome her to VOA's TV programs. Let her read listeners' comments so we can all be motivated to watch the program. James, I will absolutely do that. You can keep sending the comments and I will keep reading them on air. I also want to thank all of you for the warm welcome messages on social media. They really do mean a lot to me and I really, really appreciate them. And I hope we can continue to use the social media platform to respectfully engage with one another and discuss the issues that we feature on the show. Remember, your views are an essential part of this program, so I hope you will always keep sharing them with us. When American photographer Johnny Miller flew a drone over the cities of South Africa, he couldn't believe what his camera had captured. What he found prompted him to do the same in other cities across Africa and the world. His work went viral, even landing on the cover of Time magazine. It's all part of a visual project he calls Unequal Scenes, showing the effects of urban inequality from what he believes is the most truthful and revealing angle, the sky. He lives in Cape Town now, and I caught up with him recently during his visit to the United States.
Unequal Scenes began in 2016. I'm a photographer. I'm an American living in Cape Town. I moved there in 2012 to go to University of Cape Town, and I studied anthropology. And part of my anthropology studies was looking at the post-apartheid city, is what they said. And I realized the post-apartheid city was where I was living in Cape Town. There was blocks and streets and neighborhoods that were totally of one race, wealthy neighborhoods right next to slum neighborhoods, townships, with people living in shacks. And I felt like perhaps that's something that people in Cape Town have just grown up with. Like they don't even recognize it anymore, you know? So I thought when I had the drone, which I bought in early 2016, I thought, you know, this could be like a light bulb moment for my work, is to just get a new perspective on things. And so I actually took the drone to Table Mountain at first, and it worked. People said, we've never seen Table Mountain look like this before. Drones were relatively still new at that time. And I thought it worked. This is awesome. So I literally put the drone in the back of my car and I drove to a neighborhood called Lake Michelle, which is next to a township called Masipumalele. And I took the drone out. I put it on the ground. I flew up into the sky and the scene that emerged was the first scene from Unequal Scenes. Which became sort of a viral sensation on Facebook, was of those two neighborhoods. And when it appeared on my screen, I knew immediately that I had something important. And so when I put it onto Facebook later that night, that unequal scene went viral. And people wanted more. From there, the project just grew, and I've been really lucky to have amazing support from not only businesses, citizens, NGOs, universities, but actually government, specifically the South African government at all levels, local, provincial, and national, has been really supportive of Unequal Scenes. I can't say thanks enough for that. because it is an indictment on society as it stands now, I believe. And not just in Africa, but around the world where I've done the project. So if I have a mission with the Unequal Scenes Project, it's to create a sense of awareness of how bad the problem of inequality actually is by showing it from an unassailable position, which is from the sky. And I'm hoping that that sparks passion in people to want to change the system. Just like the environmental movement has sparked that passion with climate change. I've had people tell me that normally people present photos of inequality by showing photos of poverty. And it becomes difficult when you show photos of poverty to separate your emotional state from the photograph. So as a visual communicator, I found it's actually been really effective to use aerial photography because it does distance the viewer and change the emotional interaction with the image and with the issue. To me, it's like looking at patterns in a way, right? You're looking at sort of puzzle pieces that either go together or don't go together. In terms of an aesthetic, I really like to put like strong boundary lines in my photos, not only because of the issue that I'm dealing with, which is inequality, obviously, but because it seems to trigger people in a way when they're scrolling through social media, when they look at my photos, they seem to get triggered in a way that helps them stop, understand more what I'm trying to say, delve deeper into the issue, and then hopefully share the image. And so making your images as compelling as possible, and I feel as relevant as possible to sort of middle class viewers, which is really my target audience, is something that's not an accident anymore. So on my website, you can see I've written quite extensively about each city and about each context, which is different from place to place. The scars in the urban fabric in Cape Town, for example, are different than the scars in Nairobi, which is a city that doesn't have the same history of apartheid. It doesn't have the same legacy of infrastructure from the 20th century. So they're building it now. And I think that those issues in terms of how to create a livable, sustainable, healthy city have different motivators. They have different particulars, but the overall goal is the same. There's almost sort of a common thread and narrative that runs through all these countries in the world, all these cities in the world, that speaks to sort of our neglects of how we distribute wealth and how we create an equitable world. It's relatively easy to show these images of inequality. It's much more difficult to get into the reasons why. Understanding each local context, for example, the cities in South Africa versus the cities in Kenya and Tanzania or even Nigeria have completely different drivers for the inequality that you see. They're all tied together into the same system of disenfranchisement that global capitalism sort of enfranchises, right, and makes possible. But their local drivers are different. There's features in various cities around the world that I've photographed that are the same. And I think that that is the common thread that ties together the whole project, which is this common notion that inequality is a systemic problem across countries. And it's a disenfranchisement of an entire classes of people. For example, in India, the caste system, and then in Brazil and America, mostly economic, but also partially racially segregated, that is like a cancer in our cities, right? And I think you see that when you look at those streets that separate, for example, a slum in Mumbai from high-rise apartment buildings, and you go, that looks exactly the same as the slum in Sao Paulo, right next to high-rise apartment buildings there. And it's similar in Cape Town or Johannesburg. It's just that there's no high rises. There's like mansions. And even in America, where I'm from, where I think it's really important to focus on this project because inequality is huge in America. And it's a developed, rich country. So there's no reason for it to really exist the way it does here. What I'm hoping to do with the photographs is not focus on discrete individual photographs of poverty, but I tie this into a campaign, right? Show that this is systemic in nature. Show that inequality is similar in each city around the world. And build a movement. Help build a movement around ending inequality.
was American photographer Johnny Miller speaking to me from Seattle, Washington. And finally, the Ivorian resort town of Grand Bassam is known for its beaches and French colonial architecture. This town gives you a glimpse of the country's rich cultural and traditional heritage. But recent flooding and the passage of time have taken a toll on the city's historic buildings. Now some of its residents are determined to fix things, as Yasin Sio found in this report narrated by Carol Gunsberg.
The town of Grand Bassam, nestled by the Atlantic Ocean, is a veritable open-air museum. French colonists established it as their capital in 1893, erecting graceful buildings for government, commerce, and housing. Those colonial buildings, with verandas, colonnades, and gardens, hint at the port town's wealth early in the 20th century. Peter Teoro, a guide in Grand Bassam for over 20 years, knows the history inside and out. He points out a building named for Edouard Blackson, a logger who changed his name from Edouard Aka to make it sound more European and more appealing to European bankers.
This pretty building is Blackson House, marking part of the Ivory Coast commercial history during the colonial period. This was a stock exchange where everything was traded.
The colonial architecture and neighboring African fishing village led UNESCO to name Grand Bassam a World Heritage Site in 2012. The capital had moved from the town in 1896, and then shipping declined. Now, vegetation covers most of the colonial buildings. Many look close to collapse.
Rehabilitation is very important to our history. If we lose all our buildings, we no longer have part of Côte d'Ivoire history. And the people who no longer have history are people who are dead.
Some residents are renovating buildings themselves. One is Luc Rago, an architect who calls Grand Bassam the Ivorian Saint-Tropez, in reference to the famous French town on the Riviera.
We had to remove everything that fell. The arc existed, and here it was walled up. I wanted to open it up as a showroom. I have created a guest room to accommodate artists who will be exhibiting. I did everything in 2 months.
On the ground floor, Rago's business partner opened La Casse Bleue restaurant in early 2020, just before the pandemic. Herman N. Gasson said he developed his cooking skills in Grand Bassam.
I love this city for its history. I immediately liked this place, which was an old warehouse, and we decided to fix it up and make it something nice.
Rago and Engasan hope others will follow their example and give a second life to Grand Bassam's precious heritage. For Yasin Sio and Grand Bassam, Carol Gunsberg, VOA News.
Join us on the next Straight Talk Africa. We're going to talk about Africans working abroad. Now, as economies around the world prepare to open after multiple lockdowns, will Africans be looking for jobs overseas again? And we'll bring you the stories of young people who chase their dreams abroad and their words of caution to others. We'll also take a closer look at what international migration will look like after the pandemic. Join us right here on the next Straight Talk Africa. And do remember to connect with us on social media, Facebook and Twitter. You can share your thoughts and ideas with us there. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel. And that is where we will leave our show this week. Until next time, go well. Goodbye.